And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings to one and all. This is, of course, your provincially genial host, John Derbyshire, with VDare.com's weekly roundup of news and views. I was raised in a small country town that produced its own evening newspaper, the Chronicle and Echo, covering local events. Still in business, I see. Today's front page headline is about a fire in a Burger King near the town centre. Yep, that's my dear old hometown. That's about as much as ever happens there. Not that we didn't make a contribution to history now and then. There was the occasion when the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas à Becket, had to run for his life from the town after being convicted of disloyalty by Henry II's men in a trial at the local castle. That was in AD 1164. The townspeople are still talking about it. Well, one of my mother's minor pleasures was her evening perusal of the section at the back of that newspaper recording local births, marriages and deaths. The hatched, matched and dispatched, mother called it. In a town that small, on an average day, there's usually some family you know with a life passage recorded in the hatched, matched and dispatched columns. As a child with literary inclinations, I was especially fascinated by the little verses people sometimes included in these notices. Sample. You always made us happy, our dear loving pappy. So now that you've departed, we're left here broken-hearted. I just made that one up, but it's representative of the general standard. Hey, people do their best. In the arrogance of adolescence, I of course couldn't wait to get out of my hometown. Now that I'm older and wiser, I understand that sleepy small towns are the bedrock of civilization. I understand also that the right response to those artless memorial verses is not a condescending sneer. The right response is the one expressed by the poet Thomas Gray, reading just those kinds of verses. He called them uncouth rhymes in the country churchyard. Those verses, said the poet, implore, quote, the passing tribute of a sigh. Indeed they do. I'm telling you all this because later in the podcast I shall develop something of a theme along those lines. The lines, I mean, of birth, marriage and death. Before I get to that, though, let's take a detour through the halls of uselessness. The Halls of Uselessness is the term I used back in February in reference to the United States Congress. Anyone who thinks I was exaggerating should watch the exchange that took place Thursday this week on Tucker Carlson's show between Tucker and Mark Amoday, a fourth-term Republican Congress thing from Nevada. The topic here was the failure of the Republican Party in this Congress, a Congress that you'll recall has Republican majorities in both House and Senate under a Republican president, the failure to accomplish any significant legislative action on immigration. Tucker put the questions with his usual blunt clarity. Representative Amoday responded with clouds of squid ink. Tucker led in with the observation that as the Democratic Party moves ever further to the extreme open borders anti-USA position, they are leaving a $100 bill on the sidewalk for Republicans to pick up. Poll numbers are clear. Americans want better border control and less legal immigration. The last time we elected a president, it was a guy whose signature issue was his promise to build a wall along our southern border. So, why don't Republicans in Congress pick up this $100 bill? Listen to Representative Ammoday. Just listen to the guy.
Well, I think it's a mischaracterization of amnesty bills if you're talking to the discharge petition, because that's a procedural move to get a vote on the floor. Doesn't say you're going to vote for no borders, doesn't say you're going to support amnesty, says we really want to vote. And I expect the normal Republican process to play out in that vote. If it goes to the floor, it goes to the Rules Committee. Speaker can have a bill. You know, the nickname for the Rules Committee is the Speaker's Committee.
Yeah, no, I know.
When was the last time that Pete Sessions went rogue on Paul Ryan? So it's still firmly in control by the...
Tucker interrupted to ask why Republicans in Congress would push for amnesty without any guarantee of a secure border.
Well, in fairness, Tucker, somebody probably should define amnesty on both sides of the issue, because quite frankly, when you look at the four bills, one of them is Bob Goodlatte's, one of them is whatever Paul Ryan wants, one of them is Hurd's, and one of them is the Democrats' Dreamers Act. But just like the Senate did a couple of months ago, if none of them get 218, nothing goes through.
Tucker tried again. People voted for a border wall in the last election, he pointed out. Why haven't they got one? Why are Republicans in Congress pushing for amnesty with no border wall?
Well, I think there's a few more facts out there. First of all, the administration asked for 74 miles of wall in the last Omni. That ends on September 30th. They got 90. The administration got a 10% increase in DHS funding. So that's not we don't care about borders. I think you'll be surprised to find out if we ever get the chance to vote on something, because the House, Tucker, never has. Even the Senate's voted on this, and I've been critical of the Senate about what they don't do. If we ever get a chance to vote on immigration and border security together, which I would expect would happen, I think you'll be surprised to know how many people support border security.
Tucker expressed frank disbelief. The Congress squid squirted on in the same vein for another minute or so, telling us how eagerly he and his Republican Congress colleagues yearn to step up and vote on immigration issues, if only there weren't those darn procedural issues in the way. To an ordinary American watching that exchange, Representative Ammoday might as well have been speaking in ancient Sumerian. How many of us know, without looking it up, what a discharge petition is, or who Pete Sessions is, or what the Rules Committee does? Who is Hurd? What's an omni? What did the Senate vote on? Why is the guy boasting about 90 miles of wall when the border runs 2,000 miles? What does it mean to, quote, define amnesty on both sides of the issue? What does that mean? Amnesty just means that illegal aliens get to stay here indefinitely instead of being deported. That's what it means. On both sides of the issue. The ruling class, including most Republican Congress reptiles, wants it, and the rest of us don't. So, what do you think? Taking Representative Ammoday as, well, representative, is halls of uselessness an apt description for the US Congress? The only argument I can see against my usage, from a strictly semantic point of view, is that Congress is actually quite useful to the ruling class. The ability to smother necessary legislation in the cradle, under great puffy layers of procedural folderol like those that Mark Amodei extruded, serve their purposes wonderfully well. It's only in the area of turning voters' expressed desires into legislation that Congress is useless. If you're wondering what's actually hidden behind all that squid ink, it's a plan by Open Borders Republican Congress roaches like House Speaker Paul Ryan, Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy and Chamber of Commerce frontman Jeff Denham to kill off, once and for all, Representative Bob Goodlatte's immigration reform bill. The Goodlatte bill, you may recall, is a proposal to trade off, on the one side, amnesty for the DACA recipients and expanded guest worker programs with, on the other side, an end to chain migration and the diversity visa lottery, and somewhat improved enforcement measures, most notably mandatory e-verify. The Goodlatte bill is pretty tame by the standards of what voters actually want. It doesn't, for example, it doesn't fund a border wall. Even this milquetoast compromise is pure poison to the cheap labour lobbies, though, mainly because of the enforcement measures. Mandatory e-verify? So, Ryan, McCarthy and the 40 or so GOP Congress rodents who line up with them are desperate to kill it. That's what all this procedural kabuki is about. The GOP bosses know the voters are looking for legislation, so they intend to give it to them. The legislation they're planning to bring out, though, is another 1986 fix. Mass amnesty, garnished with vague promises about border security and reduced inflow. That's as much as donors will accept. So that's as much as the Republicans will give them. To congressional Democrats, the Goodlatte bill is, of course, a hate-filled white supremacist neo-Nazi outrage. But there's plenty of opposition to it in the donorist wing of the congressional GOP, too. Certainly enough to make passage impossible in this Congress. The Goodlatte bill has no chance of becoming legislation. If it were put to the voting public in a referendum, though, it would pass by a landslide. Hence all the procedural obfuscation. Hence all the squid ink. Immigration legislation-wise, it's always 1986. Okay, that's enough out of the halls of uselessness. It's depressing, I know, to watch the Congress folks striving so mightily to ignore the popular will. I don't set out deliberately to depress you in these podcasts. It's just that exchange with Representative Mark Amodei was such a gem, I couldn't resist it. What Mark Amodei's performance most brought to my mind, actually, was a comedian named Stanley Unwin, who appeared on British TV in the 60s and 70s. Unwin's specialty was gobbledygook. Here he is, doing Goldilocks and the Three Bears.
Goldilocks was triddly how in the early mordy, and she fallop down the steps. Oh, unfortunate, the cracking of the eggers and the sheeps and the buttery fall for lollop and graze her kneeclappers. So she had a vasalubrious, rabbit on and a quick healy huff, and that was that. So off she went, and she would triddly how down the garbage path, and at the left right-hand side, Gold...
If you'd like to hire in a gobbledygook routine like this for your next children's birthday party, I'm sure Representative Amade would oblige. Enough, enough. Let's look at larger issues. Hatched, matched and dispatched. First, let's visit the hatcheries. What's mainly happening in the hatcheries is a slowdown of business. We're not making as many babies as we used to. Headline from MSN.com. Births plunge to record lows in United States. The report is about the latest numbers on fertility from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. The key number here is total fertility rate, or TFR. That's the average number of children a woman will have in her reproductive lifetime at present rates. So we assume that when she's 25, she'll reproduce at the rate 25-year-olds are reproducing at today. When she's 30, she'll reproduce at the rate 30-year-olds are reproducing at today, and so on. That's the TFR. For a stable population, one that's neither increasing nor decreasing, you want a TFR a tad higher than 2 children per woman to allow for people who don't reproduce. Last year, the overall rate for the USA was 1.76. That's down from 1.82 the year before. A 3% drop in just 1 year. I should say the math here is not straightforward. From the definition of TFR that I just gave, you can figure, if you think about it, you can figure that TFR as calculated might be misleading. If, for example, women switch from mostly giving birth in their 20s to mostly giving birth in their 30s. This actually seems to be happening. Quote from the MSN report, the only group that saw an increase in births were women aged 40 to 44, said the report. Whether they can't afford children, or they have access to contraception and simply prefer to wait, women in their 20s and 30s continue to put off having children in America. This is a general trend that has been visible in the data, with a few ups and downs, since the 1970s. End quote. What's that? You want to know the breakdown by race? Shame on you. Since you ask, though, here is a different summary of the CDC figures at the Institute for Family Studies website. Headline there, Baby Bust. Fertility is declining the most among minority women. That's right. Where the baby bust is concerned, you can bring out the old New York Times cliche, minorities hardest hit. The biggest decline across the last decade has been among Hispanics, who went from 2.85 to 2.1. A drop of 36%. Hispanics started with a high rate, though. Our Aborigines, that's American Indians and Alaska Natives, started lower with a TFR of 1.62 and dropped to 1.23 across the decade. Nobody is sure why. Black fertility dropped from 2.15 births per woman to 1.89. Non-Hispanic whites went from 1.95 to 1.72, a comparable drop, but from a somewhat lower start point. As you can tell, the CDC report is a treasure trove for us math geeks. You can get a couple of PhD theses out of these numbers. There is, for example, a political angle. As that second study, the IFS study, reports, the TFR has fallen in every state except, mysteriously, North Dakota. However, it's fallen more in states that Hillary won in 2016 than it has in Trump states. The old conservative jeer against liberals that we'll just outbreed them at last may actually be coming true. The general decline of interest in sexual intercourse must also be playing into these numbers somehow. I have often reflected on how odd it has been across my own lifetime to see the general decline in libido all over the Western world. 50 years ago, I was there, listener, I was there, 50 years ago, when not one citizen in 100 had a gym membership, and halitosis and body odour were common, and the male-female imbalance in workplaces, clubs, sports and schools was way more marked than it is today, making it harder to get to know the opposite sex. Back in those benighted days, with all those disadvantages and deterrents, the people of the West were going at it like rabbits. The young adults of today, contrarywise, with their buff bodies, their perfect dentition and their daily showers, with sex segregation actually outlawed almost everywhere, heck, we even have women in submarines nowadays, they can't be bothered. From a report in Maxim magazine last July, based on a different set of numbers out of the CDC. Quote, between the ages of 15 and 19, 42% of women and 44% of men reported having sex, relative to 51% of women and 60% of men in 1988. End quote. It's fascinating to watch these strange currents in human tastes and behaviour. What do they tell us? What, if anything, should we do about them? This is an area where any thoughtful person can develop opinions and arguments. Fascinating. If I could have my time over again, I'd become a demographer. So much for the hatched. Now to the matched. The match at the front of this week's news is, of course, the one between Prince Harry, sixth in line of succession to the British throne, behind his dad, his brother, and his brother's three children, and American starlet Meghan Markle. There are a number of oddities here driving the tabloid gossip. The bride is 3 years older than the bridegroom. The classic formula, stated I think by Aristotle, is that the lady should ideally be half the gentleman's age plus 7. Harry is 33. Half of that is 16.5. Add 7, you get 23.5. Miss Markle is in fact 36. We're not exactly in the Emmanuel Macron zone here, but it's a slight oddity nonetheless. Then there's the race factor. Miss Markle is officially black. I say officially because she doesn't look obviously black. Her dad's white. Her mom looks to me like a quadroon, so I'm guessing that Meghan is an octoroon. Or perhaps a high yalla. This is a new thing for the British royals. It's also, again, a bit of a statistical oddity. As Steve Saylor reported 20 years ago, black-white marriages break about 72%, black guy with white gal, to 28% the reverse. Steve also noted the curious fact that white Asian marriages go the other way in exactly the same proportion. 72% white guy with Asian gal. Some people think there's a question mark over Harry's ancestry too, from the fact that he bears no physical resemblance at all to his father, and that his parents' marriage was known to be on the rocks well before he was born. I'm not sufficiently interested in the royals to have an opinion one way or the other about this. From a quick browse of the reportage on it, I would say that the case for Harry having emerged from the wrong side of the blanket is not made. But by all means, form your own opinion if you care. The bride here is also a divorcee. That's no longer uncommon among the royals. Harry's dad, Charles, is divorced, and so are two of Charles's three siblings. It does, though, add some poignancy if you're currently watching the Netflix series The Crown. The tremendous ructions over Queen Elizabeth's sister Margaret wanting to marry Peter Townsend are well within living memory. Heck, I can remember them. Notwithstanding that Townsend was a war hero, he was thought an unsuitable match for the Queen's sister because he was divorced. The marriage was quashed by the British establishment. Further back than that, of course, although still within living memory, was the liaison between Edward VIII, Harry's great-granduncle, and Mrs. Simpson, another American divorcee, which ended with Edward abdicating the throne in 1936. So the royals have loosened up a lot from the stiff formality of the middle 20th century. Taking the historical long view, of course, that button-down reserve was something of an anomaly. British royals have misbehaved more often than not, sometimes quite sensationally. I'm currently reading Ed West's book, 1215 and All That, which is about the late Norman and early Plantagenet kings. Hoo-wee! Being, of course, the very soul of geniality, I wish Harry and Meghan all the best. Wishes aside, however, there are some non-trivial reasons to wonder about their prospects. Lance Welton spells out some of those reasons in an article going up on the VDare.com website this weekend. He points out that bride and groom both come from parents whose marriages were dysfunctional, and at least one of the partners in each of those parental marriages seems to have had an unstable personality. From what we know about behavioural genetics, which is more than most people realise, Harry and Meghan's union faces unpromising odds right there. Lance Welton also argues that the interracial factor works against this marriage being successful. Here he's drawing on life history theory from biology. Life history theory. Some critters, fish for example, produce great numbers of offspring, but invest little effort in raising them, since most of them will die. Others, think of elephants, have fewer offspring, but invest more in nurturing them, expecting that most will live. That's life history theory in a nutshell. Within our own species, different races seem to practice slightly different life history strategies. Not as different as fishes and elephants, but different. In the Harry-Meghan case, if that's a factor, I think it's likely a very minor one, compared with the individual personalities in play. Heck, Meghan is only just barely black. And the live fast, die young life history strategy that is characteristic of blacks, at any rate under the heavy disease loads of the black homelands, seems to fit Meghan's white dad better than her blackish mom. Well, we'll find out. Very shortly after they do, unless tabloid fascination with the royals becomes a thing of the past. One good omen for the marriage is that when Meghan was a schoolgirl, she visited with her dad on the set of the TV sitcom Married with Children, where he worked as a lighting technician. As I pointed out many years ago in a review of that show, it was fundamentally conservative, pro-marriage, pro-family. Quote from me, "Al Bundy hates his work, but he goes to work every day nonetheless. The Bundys' marriage is stale, but they stay married anyway. The kids are slaves to their own libidos, but it's hard to imagine them doing anything unkind or seriously illegal or turning into dope addicts." End quote. Let's hope Meghan absorbed some of that conservative ethos on the set of Married with Children and brings it with her into this new union. All best wishes to them both. That's the hatched and the matched. What about the dispatched? Well, while weird things have been happening to birth rates and marriage is no longer what it used to be, death is also getting an overhaul. I'll offer a couple of data points here. First data point, the passing of notable Australian biologist David Goodall at age 104. Goodall checked into the Dignitas assisted suicide clinic in Switzerland May 8th. Then, 2 days later, he checked out of the material world under Switzerland's very liberal right to die laws. The noteworthy thing here is that Goodall was not terminally ill, nor even in serious distress, physically or mentally. He'd been having mobility issues and some problems with his eyesight, but you and I both know people in worse shape than he was in, who nonetheless wished to go on living. David Goodall just didn't. He'd had enough. He told reporters that his life stopped being enjoyable, quote, 5 or 10 years ago. Goodall's last meal was, by his request, fish and chips with cheesecake dessert. He then listened to a recording of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, passing away shortly after the music ended. The thing that surprised me there was his being able to get decent fish and chips in Switzerland. Perhaps there was an Arthur Treacher's near the clinic, I don't know. He had to go to Switzerland to die because assisted suicide is not legal in Australia. I'm betting it soon will be, and that there'll be a sea change in attitudes here all over the civilised world. Second data point. Meet Koku Istambulova of Chechnya in Russia. This lady is claimed to be 128 years old. If the claim is true, she's the oldest living person ever, so far as we know. It may not be true, as every well-researched article about extreme longevity warns, this is a zone in which false claims are abundant. From the pictures of the lady, though, I'm willing to believe that she is certainly real old. More to the point here is what she has to say about life and longevity. What does she have to say? Quote, I have not had a single happy day in my life. I have always worked hard, digging in the garden. I am tired. Long life is not at all God's gift for me, but a punishment. End quote. Sounds like another customer for that clinic in Switzerland. A lot of people feel like that. I've known some, and probably you have too. An 80-something friend of mine is fond of quoting Betty Davis's observation that old age is not for sissies. As belief in the afterlife ebbs away, and the things that once filled up our lives, work, socialising, marriage, offspring, matter less to us, you'll hear much more like this. As I said, we're heading into a sea change here, one connected with the other great changes in the hatched and matched areas. Are these things good or bad? Like all great historical processes, they are two-faced. Good in some ways, bad in others. Nuclear weapons are quite seriously bad if someone drops one on you. But they've kept the peace between great powers for my entire lifetime. I've been listening to Professor Armstrong's lectures on the Black Death, an appalling catastrophe for humanity at the time. Yet many scholars think it made the Renaissance possible, and therefore, at one remove, our comfortable modern world. I pass no opinion. Things move as they will. You can't second-guess history. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. A follow-up on my comments last month about the Stephen Lawrence case in Britain. Lawrence was the young black man murdered by white punks in London 25 years ago, and now revered as a saint by British progressives. His mother sits in the House of Lords. I quipped in those comments that perhaps London will soon be renamed Lawrence, or perhaps the entire United Kingdom will become Laurentia. Neither of those things has actually happened yet, but they're getting closer. This week came news that Lawrence's friend, Duane Brooks, who was with the Holy Martyr on the night of the murder, and who is regarded with some of the same superstitious awe as St. Lawrence himself, this guy Duane Brooks is running for Mayor of London. The current mayor is a Pakistani Muslim. Since there are no white Britons left in London outside a few billionaire precincts, I'd say that Mr. Brooks, or the Apostle Duane, whatever the correct appellation is, Mr. Brooks may be a good bet for next mayor. Are you ready for the punchline? Punchline. Brooks is running on the Conservative Party ticket. Item. Sorry to be Brit-centric, but this story follows naturally after that one. The city of Sheffield in northern England got a new Lord Mayor this week. Oh, I can hear your eyes rolling already. What are you going to tell us about the guy, Derb? He's black? He's Muslim? What? He's both. Magid Magid from Somalia is also Sheffield's youngest ever Lord Mayor, only 28. He's no Conservative either. In fact, he's a small R Republican who says he would refuse to drink a toast to the Queen. Quote from His Honour, "Minority ethnic groups are doing amazing things in this city," end quote. I'm sure they are. In other cities too. The city of Rotherham, for example, right next door to Sheffield, 20 minutes away by municipal bus. Item, some statue news. Every state of the union gets to choose two statues for the National Statuary Hall collection in Washington, D.C. Missouri is currently represented by statues of Francis Preston Blair, Jr. and Thomas Hart Benton. Both men were U.S. senators back in the 19th century. Both opposed slavery. However, before he was anti-slavery, Benton inherited two slaves. And while Blair was strong for the Union during the Civil War, he once referred to blacks as a, quote, semi-barbarous race. Oh dear. Plainly, one or other of these hateful haters has to go. Which one has not yet been determined. We know who's going to replace him, though. Harry Truman. By a vote last week of the Missouri State Senate. Surely no one could object to old Harry, could they? I wouldn't be too sure. Actual quote from a letter the 27-year-old Harry Truman wrote to Bess Wallace, his future wife, in June of 1911. Quote, I am strongly of the opinion that Negroes ought to be in Africa, yellow men in Asia, and white men in Europe and America. End quote. Uh-oh. Item. And a follow-up to that. Another story on the statues front. Jersey City boasts a monument to the Katyn Forest Massacre of 1940, when Stalin's secret police murdered 20,000 or so Polish prisoners taken in the joint Nazi-Soviet invasion of Poland the previous year. Most of those murdered were Polish army officers. They were killed individually, each with a shot to the back of the head. Now the city wants to build a waterfront park where the statue stands. They want to move the statue into storage while development takes place. There is talk, though, that the statue won't be placed back in the park for fear that the story of the massacre might trigger little children and adult snowflakes visiting the park. Over in Poland, a senator of that country, speaking on Polish radio, objected to the moving and the likely relocation of the statue. Jersey City's mayor, who is Jewish, tweeted that this guy is an anti-Semite and a white nationalist, without offering any evidence. This ignited an unseemly little spat, with Poland's ambassador to our country calling on the mayor to apologise, and the chief rabbi of Poland taking the side of the senator against Jersey City's mayor. I don't know how this will play out. Not, I hope, with the Jersey National Guard attempting another invasion of Poland. I am glad, though, to see one of the worst Soviet atrocities getting some airtime. After watching progressive morons in London celebrate May Day with banners portraying Stalin. And while I'm mentioning the horrors of Soviet communism, let me drop a reminder that this July marks the centenary of the very brutal murders, on Lenin's orders, of Tsar Nicholas II and his family. There are full descriptions of those murders online, though I recommend not trying to read them all through, unless you have a really strong stomach. Item. Just one more. Richard Remy, 51 years old, of Fort Dodge, Iowa, was shot by his dog. Man and dog were roughhousing on the couch, we are told, when the dog, whose name is Baloo, stepped on the trigger of a handgun in Mr. Remy's belt, causing Mr. Remy to suffer a gunshot wound in the leg. Man bites dog is proverbially newsworthy, as opposed to dog bites man, which isn't. But I think dog shoots man has it beat. That's all, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening. Frank Sinatra died just 20 years ago this past Monday. Since I mentioned the TV show Married with Children back there, we may as well have the theme tune for that show from Frank to play us out. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.
Love and marriage, love and marriage, go together like a horse and carriage. This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage. Ask the local gentry and they will say it's elementary. Try, try, try to separate them, it's an illusion. Try, 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 and you will only come to this conclusion. Love and marriage.